Ooh, we have an official open this week. It is another crazy week. Yep. I feel like the state's on fire finally now that we have kids back to school. The Amazon's on fire, and politics is its usual. Well, let's not call it a dumpster fire because everything's solvable, right?
That's right. I think you meant overstock.
Overstock. Oh, yes. That's a problem. Oh,
Amazon, too, though.
Should we, should we save him for last, or should we talk about him now?
I don't know. You want to talk about him now?
This, let's start with the retail. Deep state.
Okay, yeah.
This is what I wanted to do
last Friday, but we ran out of time.
Greg predicted.
So it was the weirdest thing. There was a communications release, a press release that came out of the middle of nowhere from Overstock, just sharing with us that their CEO and founder had some deep state issues, which I was like, if you did, why do you want to share? Tell us about these problems, Greg. Are you guys best friends?
I like Patrick Byrne a lot. I haven't talked to him for a long time, but he is a person. I want you to remember, Overstock.com started, and the online commerce, before it was as cool as it is today, as prevalent as it is today. They really saw, the head of the curve, saw where things were going. Patrick Byrne has been a visionary. He has really led causes, and whether they're public policy or whether they're...
cryptocurrency?
Well, I don't know if I should say it, but he had a friend that was an NBA star that went missing, and he got right involved, and I think he's been in like a 48 hours story about this this athlete.
Interesting.
So he is a combative guy when he wants to be, if he's passionate about something, and he's, I just think he's a character, but in a good way. So it was absolutely fascinating as I'm watching, at least some of the issues going on with Russia's influence in the 2016 election. It isn't simply the accusation that one campaign and people within a campaign.
Yeah.
It was a very broad effort, and they were looking at trying to influence, and even on both sides terms of.
So what was he saying? I'm confused. Was he saying that he was being influenced by Russians, looking to get information?
So, I know the answer to this question, Heidi. Here is what
deep state
has been explained.
Okay.
There is what, in the movies at least, I don't know if it's official term, Red Sparrows. These women who are spies that are from Russia that look to create relationships and get people to lower their defenses and get information from.
And, women. And by people, he means men.
Men.
There's a person.
I'm not judging. I haven't picked a gender, Mara. So what had happened was there was an individual, and she was part of this notorious meeting with Donald Trump Jr. in Trump Tower. And this person was ultimately indicted by Mueller for spreading information or doing things to undermine our elections. She's also someone that it was determined had... gotten very familiar with the NRA and a conservative, special interest group, and had been involved there. But then we found out that there was this broader effort. Well, Patrick Byrne has disclosed that she had attempted to draw close to him and use his contacts to try and draw even closer to other right of center organizations and even candidates, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Cruz. She was overtly and in a very aggressive way trying to find people that she could network with, and so it wasn't just the Trump campaign, but then also on the other side of the aisle, she was looking at ways of trying to get to know people in Hillary Clinton's campaign. I think that was...
artfully done to bring Hillary Clinton into this.
It was.
Well done.
I want to tell our viewers and listeners that... I believe that we have enough information that shows that Russia looked to undermine our democratic elections, free elections, by creating chaos, and they were not subscribing to just one campaign to do it. They were looking at a very broad way of trying to undermine and create instability in our election process, and I think that is the crux of Patrick Byrne's story, is that he went to the FBI to say, hey, she's looking at these things. It's such a crazy story, though. We've seen his company's stock fall dramatically since that press release.
I think after that first day, it was like a third of the stock fell. It was like really, really
deep. So he resigned.
He resigned today.
As CEO, and I think that was to not have the business itself be splashed by the information he's disclosing. But I think that the information he is disclosing, we'll see what happens. But I actually think that it is consistent with what we're hearing about how comprehensive Russia was in trying to undermine the election wholly.
It's a sticky story. It was also really interesting that Overstock put it out sort of very overtly over their letterhead. I mean, I'm not. It was a weird move for a corporation.
But we wanted you to know about it.
Right. Yeah. It was a strange move for a corporation. There's a little intrigue, and he sort of disclosed a lot about a relationship that you look from a corporate PR point of view. You're like, maybe we should have left out a few of those details. It was complicated. It's too bad. I mean, Overstock is a great company and a great Utah company.
Yeah.
It was a weird, it was really peculiar that Overstock sort of
And he's a smart businessman. I mean, I think he's, for his entire career, even this, though this is his company, he founded it. It's a multi-million dollar, I don't know if it's a billion dollar company, but he took $100,000 for his paycheck, and that was it. And so, he, I mean, he's a smart businessman, and he had to have known that there would be some bumps from this, so I don't know.
So this is my question, and I know we have to move on. This has been a fun topic in some ways. It's kind of, you know, the spies and everything else. There are Freedom of Information Acts, FOIA requests that have been done, and the FBI has been disclosing or turning over to these interested parties the interviews and a lot of information that is starting to make some headlines in terms of what the FBI knew at the time that the presidential election was going on in 2016. There's an Inspector General report that is due out any time, and it's a report, investigation by the Inspector General that's taken about 2 years to do. And the buzz right now in the Beltway is that there's going to be some big revelations that are going to come from this this IG report. So.
So maybe it's better
preempting.
To reveal your own.
So I wonder is he preempting some of that?
He might
because
be.
There's so much information that was classified or was not being disclosed that is now in the climate that we're in being disclosed. So there might be that interest in trying to preempt it.
Yeah.
All right. Honesty is always the best policy, but sometimes not for your bottom line. So I hope Overstock recovers, and so does he. We'll check back on that. Vice President Pence in Utah right now. We talked about this last week that it was so weird that it was quiet. He came in yesterday. Thoughts from what you saw so far?
My thoughts are, Utah Republicans, do not let the national government take credit for the good work you're doing. I look and say, hey, great. It's always great to have the president or vice president in town. But I'm also watching my feed go with all these guys saying, oh, it's so great. He's in town and he shares our values. And Merit Medical. Merit Medical is a great company. Merit Medical has greatly benefited from NAFTA. They've used those NAFTA laws well. Utah has always been on the forefront of internationalism.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's because we have so many people who serve missions or whatever. Yeah. We're an international thinking state. We've done a great job with World Trade Center. We've done a great job with thinking ahead. Merit Medical has done a tremendous job working with Canada and Mexico, two countries that President Trump's not very fond of, but I myself am very fond of. And so I look and say, and so what I think is
trilateral.
So Pence coming is terrific. It's always great. I appreciate that he sort of very much pledged that he wouldn't be fundraising. I mean, he came as an official state visit. So that's all really interesting. What I am suspect of and don't like is don't let the Trump administration take credit for work that Utah laid out, from the executive branch to the legislative branch. These are Utah's accomplishments. They're not the federal government's accomplishments. My cynical guess is no. We built a parade. He's just going to get in front of it. I will not be surprised when this comes up later and is touted by the Trump administration in terms of a success that they brought.
That it worked. But yes, Utah hopefully will be the example that is doing it right, that maybe others can be like us.
I appreciate your concern for all the policymakers and all the hard work we've done and someone trying to take the credit. But I'll tell you this. I think that in regards to international trade, it's one thing when you're seeing the trade dispute with China, when you're seeing some of these issues that this administration is taking on that are tough. If you have a state like ours that is strong with international trade, you want a red state with great relationships in international trade to have that kind of relationship, even with this administration, even with a vice president that would come to what it used to be a flyover state like Utah, to come here, because the dialogue that we can share, it's a two-way street. I really believe that these visits, there's a lot going on. They're going to want to show that what they're doing as an administration is successful. But a lot of what they're doing, as you pointed out, is the things that we do as well and how we work together. And I think that we can bring a much stronger emphasis on how the critical nature of international trade and all these trading partners that we have, that perspective to the administration. And I think that gains the confidence of people that are worried about trade with the administration and some of these tariffs that we've seen in terms of this. I think the issue with China is inevitable. We have to get to a more level playing field. I mean, they're not an emerging economy anymore. A lot of the tariffs they place on things coming in were done under the basis that they were emerging.
I would just say from my seat, Utah's approach is the opposite of the Trump's approach, and so I would say just don't let him co-opt that. Don't let him try and bait and switch.
I think it's a blend. You share what we're doing, what our best practices and successes are. We do need things consideration from the. Look, we have good companies here that we don't want to see the trade dispute escalate. We want to see resolution, and if we can as a state even express that, that's going on, I think it can work both ways.
Can I have a number two on Pence, too? Sending Pence is really strategically smart. What I find interesting is, you know, when we talk about Pence, we're like, we're so glad he came. He's someone who can share our values, and I'm so glad that he's here. All I say to voters are, if you're looking for someone who shares your values, if that's part of maybe how you vote,
maybe think about who his boss is.
I'm just saying, if values are how you vote,
I know there's a narrative that the president's not popular in Utah, but if you look at among even primary voters and they did favorability rating, Governor Herbert scored the highest, but Trump is not far behind in terms of favorability with Republicans in the state of Utah, which were a red state. I think that they make a great team. I think that Utah is a culture where President Trump's personality doesn't translate as well. I'll give you that, but on measurables, on keeping campaign promises and doing the things that he said he would do, I think it's unique for this president. We haven't seen a president, I think, of any party that's been as true to their word in terms of the things they said they do. So I think it's a good thing. They make a great team.
They make an interesting team, and I'll tell you one thing before we move on to the next topic. I actually posted a little clip of video, and I was glad it happened yesterday. But Jenny Taylor, Major Brent Taylor's wife and son, got to meet him there and speak to the vice president. And I think if you've lost someone in war to Afghanistan, that's got to be amazing, meeting the vice president of the United States. They got to go look at the airplane. But when I posted just that snippet of video, I had nothing to do with politics, but just this nice moment for the family. Most of the comments were about how they hated Pence and a lot of those LGBTQ issues. So while he does have a lot of the conservative Christian vote, I think even here in Utah, he ruffles feathers because he's not very welcoming to the LGBT community, which I think Utah's doing a good job at being welcoming
to. That's actually a good point. He's actually taken arrows for being too puritanical or too...
That was certainly his record before he was the vice president. Yeah. I mean, that was the dialogue around him, I should say, before
he was vice president. All right. Yeah. Interesting. Next topic here. We have an interim legislative session, maybe. It's been rumored that the governor might do this in September. This is what surprised me yesterday. The state is going to abandon the DABC-style control over medical cannabis. Did you see this coming, Gregory?
No, look, I will take full ownership. I was part of the group that came to an agreement on medical cannabis where we took the sides that were either in support of the initiative or opposed and found common ground to make sure that we were going to deliver for those in need medical cannabis in a way that protected public safety and protects public safety but doesn't have it so unregulated that you call it medicine, but it really isn't. So there was this, you know, fine line, a difficult one to reach. In that process, there was a desire to make sure that access in rural Utah, where a retail establishment might not have the population to support it, a central fill where you could access by phone and through the internet, on a website, a licensed pharmacist be able to order it, and then be able to pick it up at a local or a county health department. So 29 was going to increase access. The reason we did not believe that that it would be a problem is that, and I still hold this opinion, is that anyone who tells me that a county health department that you would go to pick up, you'd order it online, but you would pick it up there, if that's illegal, I would argue all of marijuana is illegal. It's the Controlled Substance Act prohibits it across the board. So if you have a state like California or you have a state like Nevada or Colorado that allows for recreational cannabis, and you're the Justice Department and you're looking and you're going to wake up one of these mornings because there's 35 states now that have it, either medicine or medical and recreational. If you're going to start trying to enforce the law, do you go for a state that's doing its level best to create, you know, protections to public safety and make sure it's being done with licensed pharmacists and doctors? Or are you going to go after those states that have recreational? And it's our argument that this law is being egregiously violated in many states, and
having like government employees be the ones handing out.
And it's not there are medical cannabis specialized pharmacies around Utah by number that are walk up.
Yeah.
But it was really meant as a central fill, was meant to make sure that everyone, even in more remote areas, had access.
I loved.
It's fine if they want to take that part out. It wasn't part of the. Right. You know, everything's a compromise, and there's different sides that come with different ideas. That was a Senate idea. But I will tell you that I believed in what they were trying to accomplish. I thought it was for the good of people and really trying to create a better access. So if they want to take that part out, I think it limits access, but it's fine.
I actually appreciate that Utah did try a slight, like, so we're the next in line to try and legalize something that isn't legal for the federal government, right? I appreciated that we did try something new, and I do think it was worth the discussion. And one of the things from my seat, this group that got together was quite earnest, and this group that got together was real-time looking through ideas. I think they were a little rushed in it, maybe as a byproduct.
Before the election, that group you're talking
before
about.
Before the election, and then right after. Yeah. I think there was some pressure to solve some things. And so there was a little bit of moving forward, and I think this is the byproduct of having a little bit of time to sort through. I do want to give credit for at least exploring a different idea. The one thing I think that should be noted in perhaps a few of the special session agenda items are that in the instances of perhaps Medicaid and certainly the instance of medical marijuana, it seems as though we're moving to the position that the voters sorted through and worked on and that the legislature tried to override. It seems like we're sliding back to the voters' position and we're sliding back to maybe what was probably some good law to deliberate before the legislature decided to overturn them.
Yeah, and so the decision, and I think I misspoke earlier, I said that we might have an interim session. We have an interim session now. We're talking about a special session coming, which would be in September. So what they're talking about now is 12 private dispensing, and originally the law called for 7 private. So if we're going back to what the voters voted for, is this actually them getting less, Greg, than what we thought of? Because 12 is not a lot. It's a big state.
Was it a proposition or an initiative? I can't remember.
Initiative.
So I think it was going to allow a certain number in every county. So
yeah,
you
that's
had
what I might
bottom
remember.
Line, you could have had as many as 29 because there's 29 counties. Yeah. But then some more populated counties would have had more. But again,
the delivery fills that space, right?
Yeah, that's what delivery. That delivery was. It was meant to fill where you're not going to have a population where retail is just going to make sense. But
porch piracy is going to go up in the state of Utah when it starts.
So I will tell you the biggest difference and why I think part of it was rushed because we wanted voters, when you had this initiative in front of you, we thought it was important that the voters and the public in general know that there was common ground that was being arrived at. And we thought that was substantive and in a transparent way say, look, we're bringing sides together here. The biggest problem with the initiative as it was written that I think would have required a special session, and they would have, or they would have had to change it after, you know, during the general session, is the affirmative defense, where any possession of cannabis or marijuana at all needed to be assumed to be for medical purposes, and law enforcement or the prosecutors would have to prove that it wasn't used for medicine, which puts the onus on your law enforcement, which is a high bar. And what it really means, what law enforcement would tell us is, they're just not going to enforce it because it's just too much to assume that everybody's using it for medical reasons. I think it was written that way with the best of intentions, but the unintended consequence would have been no real bright line between medical and recreational. And so I think that was another thing that we needed to – it wasn't talked about a lot when they were talking about medical cannabis, but it was – I think something that was going to make that bill hard, or that proposition or initiative hard to enforce without change.
Mm-hmm. All right, so more problem solving to come. Mm-hmm. Greg, I know you have something to say on this next issue. That's why you're going to have to go second.
Oh, no.
We're going to talk about Operation Rio Grande. It's the 2-year anniversary.
One. I thought it was the other one.
No, we've got more. I'm trying to figure out which one you were groaning about.
The one where you two are going to gang up
on.
Oh,
no, that hasn't happened yet.
Those are quality issues.
Operation Rio Grande, we keep talking about this. They had a news conference. They had a woman who was caught up in some of the arrests, who was doing drugs, dealing drugs. She says it saved her life. And I think there's stories like hers. I don't know how many stories where you're like, okay, this is working. When you drive down to Rio Grande or walk down there, I don't feel like I'm going to get stabbed to death. But Mara, did it work? Or have we just moved the problem and we're celebrating prematurely issues that still exist, but maybe across from the police department at the library or wherever
we're
else
celebrating too prematurely. And I hate to say it because I'm not trying to criticize anyone. Yeah. Good work is being done.
Yeah.
Good work has been done. We have the right people doing the right things. I'm not trying to, Monday morning quarterback here, but We keep huzzah, the results are in. From what? We were going to a distributed model, of which I'm very suspect, but giving some room for it to work. it hasn't even started yet for many criticisms we talked about in the past. So there's no new model.
Yeah.
And yet we're celebrating the success of this new model that hasn't, I mean, I should say nothing's happened. We're good people are working every day on this issue. But what I keep seeing is invested brokers celebrating for political reasons where I'm like, could we just let the process work? Let's not corner people doing good work. If you celebrate, I mean, a mayor several years ago sent out a piece where he was celebrating that they had solved homelessness and veterans. And I remember thinking, but you didn't. So so now we have that. I feel the same way.
Yeah.
We have a problem. It's still a problem. We're all dedicated to it. The state has stepped in. As a Salt Laker, I would like to reclaim some of the space the state has taken over with a real sincere debt of gratitude for moving that along. There's still so much in play. We haven't opened any of the shelters. I'm a little confused why we keep celebrating things that I don't see we've had the chance to evaluate yet. And I really think that's poor public policy.
Yeah. And I think the 2-year mark is a good time to do a doctor's checkup and, you know, check lube oil filter, see how we're doing. And I did like hearing there were success stories. Are they the norm, or are we plucking these out and there really are more problems than
let me break down this issue, because sometimes they get blended together and they're very different issues. The legislature, I sit in the cheap seats now. I just watch this from afar. But I was a Speaker of the House, and we had Mayor Ben McAdams, and we had our city mayor and city council. We were looking for a new model because the model in terms of helping people experiencing homelessness did not look like it was working. But that's not unique to Salt Lake City. If you look around the country, we have medieval diseases coming back in Los Angeles because you have a growing population and a problem that no one really knows how to address. We were seeing some of those same symptoms in terms of it was growing and getting beyond our ability to help. And so there needed to be something different. And so the model of resource centers instead of shelters and trying to get people like single women and women with children in their own facility, and trying to have smaller facilities where the anonymity doesn't rule the day, where you can learn people's background and what their needs are so that you can address them. It made all the sense in the world. And so the state entered into that space and wanted to help with the funding of these resource centers. So we put, and it was hard because this was something that Salt Lake County was coming up with. And if you have lawmakers from every corner of the state and you have only finite resources, a lot of lawmakers were walking away from other appropriations to really prioritize joining with the Salt Lake County Mayor and Salt Lake City to address this. But it was okay. We have people that aren't all just from Salt Lake City that are experiencing homelessness. It is a state issue. In the summer of 17, so we had two sessions where we put real dollars towards this.
Yeah.
In the summer of 2017, we had maybe 6,000 or more people. 6,000 or more people camped out, lined the streets. We had, the jail beds were full. There was booking restrictions, so you could buy heroin, use heroin.
And they couldn't do anything.
In the company, in the presence of a law enforcement officer, and there was no recourse or no consequence. The lawlessness, the violence, even the deaths were growing at an unsustainable rate. We were losing volunteers in the area that were trying to help.
So is that a success now?
So this is what I want to say. Resource centers was one effort, and the state was involved. To protect that investment and to protect that effort, because that's 150 or 200 beds with three resource centers. So do the math.
Yep.
We had to address the lawlessness, but the Operation Rio Grande was a 24-month effort.
Right.
It had a beginning, there's a middle, and it has an end. My concern is that that end was supposed to occur on June 30th of 2019. That was when the successful transition from the downtown shelter, the people, to these resource centers. That was supposed to happen, and it hasn't happened
yet. And leadership is less clear than it was 2 years ago.
You have President Niederhauser, who is the president of the Senate. He's gone as well. So some of that political, it's one thing that we had, this was our effort.
Yeah.
When you have new presiding officers in a legislature, they're going to try to make sure things don't fall through the cracks, but they have their issues that are coming at them as well. So you've lost some of that institutional knowledge with some of us leaders that have left, but there's enough there that transition needed to happen. But that's why we put it in statute, because it was that important that we make sure that there was a sense of urgency.
Right.
We sit here at the end of August and we're not seeing that transition happen completely. It has to happen. And you cannot say that Operation Rio Grande, now that we're extending it because we haven't created that transition, is successful until we see that happen. Now, thank goodness, I think the numbers have lowered to the point where we can have that successful transition, where if you go back to 17, I think there were too many people.
It's different. I don't see anyone shooting up heroin when I'm getting off the 4 South exit to get to work, which is an improvement.
And know this, too. We budgeted in that two-year effort, law enforcement, Department of Public Safety, any law enforcement that would see the diversion into their communities.
UHP's pulled a big share of that. Are they still going to be here until the shelters are open, or are they back out on the highway?
They didn't ask for this job, but they've done it in a phenomenally, they've done a great job. I think there should be a role. I think it's up to the UHP. They have the right to decide whether they want to stay in this space. I think that everyone would be benefited if they, I've done ride-alongs and walk-alongs with the troopers, and they feel it has strengthened their ability as peace officers and law enforcement officers to be engaged. I think there'll be a role, not the one they have today, but I think a continued role would be wise if they want it. But the issue was we had to get these numbers in control. We couldn't have competing drug cartels fighting for market share. We couldn't have jail bed restrictions where nothing, you could enforce anything. You had to be able to incarcerate people.
And I'm hoping new leadership in Salt Lake keeps bringing this up. I mean, it is largely defined in municipal areas. I think South Salt Lake has a lot to say about what's next. So again, I'm just going to say, I don't know if it serves us too well to just be celebrating instead of educating us and showing us the path forward a little
bit. What are the numbers? What's happening next?
When you celebrate, then you exclude me even from being a part of it. This is everyone's issue. This isn't just in Salt Lake. This is in the whole metro area. And I would encourage these leaders to articulate that more instead of just saying, because when they celebrate it and I still go to work downtown and I'm still walking over people to go to work, I'm now impatient because you've told me it was solved.
Sure. Let me just finish with this. The diversion. We don't believe that you saw 6,000 people that were in one location in the summer of 17 and now those same 6,000 are other places. We've seen, and the other misconception is that it was just a law enforcement sweep. It was not. You have more treatment beds than ever before. You have dignity of work programs with employers where we're trying to help people find employment. And then you have the lawlessness and law enforcement.
But the arrest model you should be criticized. You went to an arrest model
was surveillance, and there were those that were fountainheads of drug dealing. It wasn't sweeping the street from one end to the other. There was people that seemed to be the purveyors of drug, whether they were preying upon people.
Sure.
And we tried to spot, and they tried to spot the people that were really harming people the most in terms of how, because it was still limited jail beds that you could use. But the diversion, there was in that budget to work with law enforcement where that diversion could happen or has happened to work with law enforcement to address that as well. Yeah. So I think that we've seen things improve markedly, but it's not over by any means.
Definitely not over. So we will check back in with them. We'll see how this goes. Next issue is Mara's issue and Heidi's issue, but we'll maybe let you go.
I know. This is the one I thought you guys were going to gang up on me.
August 26th is an exciting day. It's Women's Equality Day. And while it has started to look at all the numbers in the state, this is not exactly breaking news. But it is a reminder, again, Utah coming in dead last for workplace environment, which includes wages, hours worked, unemployment rate. And I know a lot of people are like, well, we have a lot of stay-at-home moms here, and it's because they're out of the workforce. This says the wage gap has nothing to do with choices to raise a family because the gap still exists for female professionals with and without children. Why is this still an issue?
So let me ask this question. Now look.
Why can't we just pay
first?
Women
I'm setting the
worth.
Rules on this topic Freedom right rights. Now before you
don't start defensive.
You guys are going to start swinging at me. I want you to know, I was raised. I was a little boy. I lived with my grandmother who worked full time, my mother who worked full time, and my aunt who worked full time. I am intimately aware that anyone who is in the workforce needs a wage for the work they do, and it needs to be, you don't want to see a disparity, and you don't want someone judged because of their gender. I agree with that. But let me ask you this. If you have, in the field of medicine, if you were to look at who would like to be a pediatrician versus who would like to be a surgeon, they're not the same profession. And I'm telling you,
seriously?
My daughter
so
Sophie.
With you. I was so with you for your
listen,
opener, Greg.
My daughter Sophie.
I was with
women
you.
Chop like, people up like in the surgery
quality,
room too.
There are studies that show that quality of life, time, the time that you have, the risks that you would take or not take in the profession that you have, gender equality cannot mean that we are exactly the same people and that we
but
like the same things
no
or gravitate to the same type of profession.
That's old school.
So,
no one thinks that equality is exactness.
So some of those higher paying jobs there's a lot more risk to it, or there's stress to it, or the time.
Right, and our point is when the woman is doing the exact same job. I agree with you. If people aren't doing the same job, they don't get the same pay. So here, I want to get in because I support you.
They're not narrowing down that specifically. They're just saying doctors and physicians, and they say, look, the men are making more than the women, and they're being more broad in those professions.
An important point that you're making is gender discrimination is not necessarily men versus women. It's women versus women. We know from earlier studies in Utah that one of the most discriminating genders in Utah is actually women discriminating against women. So first, you're off the hook. It's not a gender-based issue. But it is telling that in this study, the highest number was 77, and Utah was 25. And then in the bastion of liberalism that is the Salt Lake Tribune self-proclaimed space, I'm reading this article, and they go on to tell us how we're different from Idaho, which is number 49. And I'm like, even the Tribune only aspires to be number 49 instead of 50 in this discussion. But it is true that particularly when it comes to education, women start college here at a higher rate than men, but they don't finish college. Yeah. There is a cultural component to how we feel. We as women and men, it is important that sort of some of these biases don't live in genders. It's not that men are doing this to women. But Utah routinely ranks. And one of the things that I'm most worried about is that we would even attempt to do, why are we defending? Like, I'm not meaning this to be this personal, but why do you need to defend this? Why don't you embrace this, Greg, and say, yes, what should we be doing to give women more options? Because I will tell you, and we won't wear this.
We want your daughter to have a fighting chance.
So do I.
But Heidi
Sophie
and I,
will have a fighting chance. She's
Heidi
not asking
and I,
permission.
Every day of the week have sat in rooms in which the equality table was not based on our performance. It was not based on me doing an equal job for an equal pay. It was not based on any of my behavior. It was not based on any of my work ethic, my ability to do quality of life. It was based on nothing but my gender. And so, why aren't you seeing this as a puzzle to tease out?
We were four inches.
Maybe because I don't see. I had.
We got to look you in the eye.
Yes.
And be
well,
more aggressive.
So my staff, when I was speaker, I had female staffers as well as male, and
we've
we
established that you're liberal. I don't think you're discriminatory.
I want to point this out. I'm going to bring up your favorite former public servant, Hillary Clinton. In the 90s, there was a comment she made that really people really talked about. Look, I could have stayed home and had teas and baked cookies, but I went and did something with my life. I think there is this bias or this worry that if you've decided to stay home and raise your children, and I've actually heard this from people that I love, that they feel that their life was, that they had underperformed or not done as well in life because they chose to be a mother instead of.
Still a valid job.
And I will tell you that is a self-deprecating assessment of oneself if they think that the job that they did was wrong. And I think these discussions of how much people make in the workplace, to the culture of Utah, it ignores some of the work and some of the things that
but I'm trying to expand that discussion. Access to education is a problem. Access to flexible care is a problem.
Aren't women getting more bachelor's degrees than men now?
We start with more and we don't end with more. But the point being, overt racism, overt discrimination, overt oppression is not where this happens. It happens much more subtly. It's not an indictment anymore on what women choose to do.
You're both professional women. Do you think it's a life unlived if you didn't have a profession?
But you're still asking us to evaluate the quality of life based on women.
No, but I have chosen to go to work, and my husband's the stay-at-home parent in our family. And so when I look at my family, where I'm the sole supporter, if I'm making 75% of what a man would in my job, that's lame because it's going to take me many more years to retire and make sure my kids can go to college. And same things if you go for a family where both a husband and a wife have to work. I'm guessing the husband would like it if it was a wife, you know, got what she was worth. If you do stay home, I think there's value in that.
And so forget gender, but for someone that stays home, there's nothing, I think that's a life well lived.
Absolutely.
I think that should be as equivalent to a wage and a profession as anything else. And so sometimes I worry about these, how we measure up the wages, even studies that show entrepreneurialism, women that start businesses versus men and how they structure those businesses and what free time versus, you know, time that you don't have. They're not identical.
So where is an area for us to improve women's access to whatever you want?
You know what?
Whatever you feel like giving to us.
It's your world. I just live in it. I'm just acknowledging that now. No, I will tell you that I think that if there are these instances that you're describing where you think that it is truly on level, it's not because someone had children and left the workforce for a while, then came back in, because statistically speaking, anybody who would leave a profession and come back in later is going to have to start again. And so if you're not counting those things and it's just apples for apples, I think that for people like me, we don't see it apples for apples. We think that this culture and other variables are playing into that gap. And if it's not, then you need to do a better job of telling me.
All right, we'll let you know.
Okay, cut this short. We're done here. Stop the show.
Another hour.
We can all hang out at the Utah Tech Corridor, because I'm hearing that they're doing a great job with parental leave for men and women and making sure they have the support they need. And I think maybe they have the right idea to help women and men. And so maybe we need to look to them, because we can solve this problem. Because
I agree.
Girls are nice, boys are nice, and we all just want to get paid super nice.
I agree. I agree with both of you.
Riveting.
As much as I can.
Can we just make this end right
Yeah,
now?
I totally objected to this topic.
Let's not do it.
I didn't think this topic would go well for me.
You wanted to repress it is what I would say.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not at all.
Well, thanks for playing along, both of you.
I tried.
Mara Mirabello, Greg Hughes, as always, fun to hang out on a Thursday afternoon today. Thanks so much, and enjoy the rest of your week. Subscribe and tell your friends about us.